Today is Wednesday, July 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump takes action against China over Hong Kong.
I signed legislation and an executive order to hold China accountable for its oppressive actions against the people of Hong Kong.
Plus, good news about a COVID-19 vaccine.
U.S. researchers reported that this early-stage study found the vaccine was safe and induced immune responses in all 45 healthy volunteers.
We'll have those stories and more next. Beijing warned of retaliatory sanctions against the United States Wednesday after President Donald Trump ordered an end to Hong Kong's special economic relationship with the U.S. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying said the Hong Kong Autonomy Act slandered the new national security law and undermines the basic principles of international law. Trump signed legislation Tuesday that slaps sanctions on Chinese officials who undermine Hong Kong's autonomy and an executive order that ends preferential treatment to the Chinese Special Autonomous Region. In his remarks, Trump sought to portray himself as tougher on China than his political opponent, Joe Biden. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Witikaswara starts us off.
President Donald Trump announced his administration's latest move to pressure China.
Today I signed legislation and an executive order to hold China accountable for its oppressive actions against the people of Hong Kong.
The Hong Kong Autonomy Act imposes sanctions on people or entities that conduct business with Chinese officials responsible for implementing Beijing's new national security law in Hong Kong. The legislation also gives the president the power to seize the officials' assets and block their entry to the U.S. Zach Cooper is a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies U.S. strategy in Asia.
I think the administration is saying that this is probably a signal that we're past the point of trying to convince Beijing to back off from Hong Kong and now just imposing costs on it for the behavior that it's taking.
Trump's executive order ends preferential treatment for Hong Kong, which will now be treated the same as mainland China. This week, the Trump administration also succeeded in pressuring Britain to remove Chinese telecom giant Huawei from its 5G network. The president positioned himself as tougher on China than his opponent, Democratic former Vice President Joe Biden, the presumptive candidate running against Trump in the November election.
Joe Biden's entire career has been a gift to the Chinese Communist Party and to the calamity of errors that they've made.
Biden has criticized Trump for instigating a trade war with China and also presents himself as tough on Beijing.
The Chinese are spending multiple billions of dollars trying to own the technology of the future while we sit with our thumb in our ear.
China will be an important issue in the U.S. election, says Zach Cooper.
Both sides are a bit vulnerable here, and I think, frankly, the president might be more vulnerable. You know, the president's got a trade deal with China, which he signed this January, and the trade deal doesn't protect against some of the very things that the president seems to be most upset by right now. And it included provisions about agriculture purchases, which are particularly helpful, obviously, in electorally important states in the upper Midwest.
Trump recently said that relationship with China has been severely damaged by Beijing's handling of the pandemic and that he is not interested in talking to China about the second phase of the trade deal. Meanwhile, China is imposing sanctions on American defense firm Lockheed Martin after Washington approved a potential $620 million upgrade package for missiles to Taiwan and sanctions against Republican Senators Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, both known to be critical of China. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
The New York Times said on Tuesday it will transfer some of its staff out of Hong Kong. AP correspondent Charles De Ledesma has that part of the story.
The move comes amid uncertainties about practicing journalism in the Chinese territory under its June 30 national security law, which aims at curbing dissent after months of anti-government protests last year. The paper says some of its employees face challenges in securing work permits to work in Hong Kong, which until recently had rarely been an issue in the city, and were obstacles mostly faced by journalists working on the mainland. Hong Kong has long been seen as China's last bastion of press freedom and is a hub for many foreign news outlets reporting on Asia and mainland China. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Young activists and so-called localist candidates dominated Hong Kong's unofficial pro-democracy primaries, in which hundreds of thousands of people voted despite warnings the election could violate Beijing's new security law. Voters selected young activists like Joshua Wong and incumbent lawmakers to whittle the list of pro-democracy candidates before a legislative election in September. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam has warned the organizers and the candidates that the election could be considered subverting state power if the objective is to resist every policy initiative of the government. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo congratulated the pro-democracy camp, saying that the over 600,000 Hong Kongers who voted have demonstrated their desire to make their voices heard. Researchers on Tuesday announced that Moderna's experimental vaccine for COVID-19 showed it was safe and provoked immune responses in all volunteers in an ongoing early-stage study. Reuters' Libby Hogan has more.
The first COVID-19 vaccine tested in people showed early promising results on Tuesday. Biotech firm Moderna was the first to start human testing of an experimental vaccine for the coronavirus in March. US researchers reported that this early stage study found the vaccine was safe and induced immune responses in all 45 healthy volunteers. Top US infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci called the results good news. His researchers developed Moderna's vaccine candidate, and he says it produced, quote, reasonably high levels of antibodies. Another positive outcome was the lack of serious side effects. However, more than half of the participants reported moderate reactions like fevers, headaches, and chills. The team says these were more likely to occur after a second, larger dose and in people who got the trial's highest dose. When injected into people, Moderna's vaccine instructs cells to make proteins that mimic the outer surface of the coronavirus. The body recognizes this as a foreign invader and mounts an immune response against it. The federal government is supporting Moderna's vaccine with nearly $500 million and has chosen it as one of the first to enter large-scale human trials. Moderna started its Phase 2 trial in May and expects to begin a Phase 3 trial at the end of this month. It will be conducted in some 30,000 volunteers.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. As the world passed 13.3 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, doctors in France are reporting what is believed to be the first case in which COVID-19 was transmitted from a pregnant mother to a baby in the womb. A report in the science journal Nature Communications says a 23-year-old woman in the late stages of pregnancy tested positive for COVID-19 after she was admitted to a Paris hospital with a fever and a severe cough. Her child was delivered via emergency cesarean section 3 days later. Tests were run on the baby's blood and fluid from his lungs after he showed signs of distress and revealed a positive result for coronavirus infection. Further tests show that the virus had spread from the mother's blood into the placenta, where it replicated and passed on to the baby. Dr. Danielle DeLuca, the director of pediatrics and neonatal critical care at South Paris University, as well as the lead researcher of the study, says the baby recovered without specific treatment and is clinically normal. The mother has also recovered. VOA has continued and expanded coverage of the pandemic on our website. And still to come.
In the United States, federal troops can only be used to conduct law enforcement activities in very limited and prescribed circumstances. President Trump was trying to expand the scope by claiming that he has a law and order responsibility, but in our system, that responsibility primarily lays with local leaders and state governors.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Back in 2018, a team of scientists from the Australian National University discovered the fastest-growing supermassive black hole in the known universe. The giant black hole is trying to gobble huge amounts of matter so quickly that it also produces an ultra-luminous quasar. The black hole, simply identified as J2157, is located 12.5 billion light-years from Earth. Since its discovery, the team has conducted further research and has released a new study that provides more detailed information. According to the study's lead author, Christopher Onken, the giant black hole has a mass equivalent to 34 billion times our sun, consumes an amount of matter that's nearly the equal of one sun every day, and is 8,000 times bigger than Sagittarius A, the supermassive black hole in the center of our Milky Way galaxy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The International Organization for Migration says tens of thousands of Ethiopian migrants stranded in war-torn Yemen are in fear for their lives as COVID-19 spreads throughout the country and life-saving aid is in short supply. Lisa Schlein has those details.
More than 1,460 cases of coronavirus, including 418 deaths, are reported in Yemen. But aid agencies believe the true number is much higher. As this deadly disease spreads widely throughout local communities, the UN Migration Agency warns thousands of Ethiopian migrants are at greater risk. IOM spokesman Paul Dillon says migrants are subject to forcible relocation, arbitrary detention and abuse, as well as fear of falling sick and dying from COVID-19, with little prospect of receiving treatment.
For nearly 6 years, Yemen has been an extremely unsafe place to be a migrant. COVID-19 has made this situation worse. Migrants are scapegoated as carriers of the virus, and as a result, suffer exclusion and violence. In addition to the forced removals, fears about COVID-19 have led to migrants in Yemen experience verbal and physical harassment, increased detention, and movement restrictions.
Yemen traditionally has been a country of transit for impoverished Ethiopians seeking work and a better life in Saudi Arabia. The International Organization for Migration says the number of migrant arrivals in Yemen has decreased by 90% in recent months because of COVID-19-related restrictions. Dillon says most of the stranded Ethiopians are sleeping in the open or in unsafe, abandoned buildings. That puts them at greater risk of exposure to COVID-19. He tells VOA access to the migrants has always been difficult in the conflict-ridden country. However, he notes COVID-19 is what he calls a new variable.
We need to ensure that our protocols and our responses to people in need follow strict safety guidelines in order to protect our staff, some of whom have become ill with COVID-19. Many of the people are in urban areas, seeking out new places to sleep every night, moving from place to place, and that can really challenge the ability to deliver support services to migrants.
IOM spokesman Dillon says the migrants lack basic services, including food, clean water, and health care. He says his agency's $155 million appeal to support more than 5.3 million people in Yemen this year is only half funded. If the needed funds are not received, he warns millions of displaced Yemenis and migrants will be left to face the devastating and worsening crisis by themselves. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Activists in South Africa have beheaded a statue of British colonialist Cecil Rhodes, a 19th century diamond magnate who became wealthy through the labor of black miners and then limited the amount of land they could own. The statue in Cape Town is the latest targeted as part of a global reckoning over racial injustice sparked by the May death of George Floyd, a black man in the United States who died at the hands of police. Park rangers patrolling the Table Mountain area found the statue's decapitated head earlier this week. South Africa National Park spokeswoman Lauren Clayton said on Wednesday, the statue's head already was missing its nose, which had been gouged off previously by activists. A European Union High Court has ruled in favor of technology giant Apple in Ireland in its dispute with the EU over $15 billion in back taxes. The Luxembourg-based General Court said that the multinational does not need to pay the billions the EU Commission has called for. The EU Commission had claimed that Apple had an illegal sweetheart tax deal with Irish authorities. A U.S. judge on Tuesday denied bail for Ghislaine Maxwell, Jeffrey Epstein's longtime associate, who's accused of luring young girls so the late financier could sexually abuse them after she pleaded not guilty at her arraignment hearing. Reuters Jillian Kitchener has that story.
The 58-year-old, appearing by video from a Brooklyn jail, pleaded not guilty to six criminal charges, four related to transporting minors for illegal sexual acts, and two for perjury. Inside a Manhattan federal court, Annie Farmer, who has accused Maxwell of enabling her abuse from Epstein, said that Maxwell, quote, has never shown any remorse for her heinous crimes, and that the danger Maxwell poses must be taken seriously. Prosecutors had argued Maxwell was an extreme flight risk. The judge agreed, saying Maxwell, quote, demonstrated sophistication in hiding her resources and herself. Maxwell was arrested earlier this month in Bradford, New Hampshire, where authorities said she was hiding out at her 156-acre property she bought in December in an all-cash transaction with her identity shielded. Her lawyer said she moved there to escape unrelenting and intrusive media coverage. But prosecutors on Monday said FBI agents had to forcibly enter her home to arrest her as she hid in an interior room and found a cell phone wrapped in tinfoil in an apparent effort to evade detection. Maxwell's former friend and associate, Jeffrey Epstein, who was charged with sexually exploiting dozens of girls and women from 2002 to 2005, was found dead in a New York City jail last August in an apparent suicide. The judge scheduled Maxwell's trial date for July next year. Prosecutors have said Maxwell could face up to 35 years in prison if convicted.
Jillian Kitchener reports for Reuters News. By both law and long-standing tradition, the United States military must be kept separate from domestic politics and law enforcement, except under rare and specific circumstances. This was put to the test early last month, when peaceful demonstrators were tear-gassed and forcibly dispersed from near the White House to make way for President Donald Trump to walk with federal military leaders and others to pose for a photo opportunity at a nearby church. To find out more about the legal issues and the controversy that followed and the historic separation between military and civil society in the U.S., VOA's Adam Phillips spoke via Zoom with Ohio State University military history professor Peter Mansour. Mansour is a retired U.S. Army colonel and the co-editor of the recent book, The Culture of Military Organizations.
In the United States, federal troops can only be used to conduct law enforcement activities in very limited and prescribed circumstances. President Trump was trying to expand the scope by claiming that he has a law and order responsibility, but in our system, that responsibility primarily lays with local leaders and state governors.
In a nutshell, what are the prescribed circumstances under which federal troops can be called in by the executive branch?
So under the Insurrection Act of 1807, the president can call forward federal forces to suppress rebellion against the United States. And that law was later expanded after the U.S. Civil War to include protection of U.S. citizens and their 14th Amendment rights. For instance, the president can use federal forces to enforce desegregation and court orders. And he can also use federal forces at the invitation of state governors, but it's not the broad categories under which President Trump wanted to use the forces.
Remind our listeners what happened exactly during President Trump's very controversial walk from the White House across Lafayette Square.
So in the Lafayette Square incident, you had a crowd of people who were peacefully protesting, and the president decided to use force to clear them out of the square so he could walk across Lafayette Square to St. John's Episcopal Church and hold up a Bible. This was clearly a political photo opportunity for the president, and the use of force was not justified. The protesters were merely inconveniencing the president, but they weren't doing anything illegal. The only way I think he could make a case is if the violence or the insurrection, if you will, would have to reach a level where U.S. authority would no longer be recognized in that locality, and that would require perhaps the use of federal forces to reassert U.S. sovereignty in that area.
What is the underlying legal rationale for limiting the role that the federal military can play in domestic politics like protests?
The framers of the Constitution clearly remembered King George III and his use of troops to put down rebellion, to disrupt their assemblies, to disband their political institutions. And they wanted to create a document that would prevent that sort of power being held by any individual, even one as powerful as the president.
And yet we often see National Guard troops called in to quell riots and civil disturbances. National Guard troops are state soldiers. But why is that different?
National Guard forces answer to the state governor only when they are federalized under specific circumstances, such as wartime. Do the National Guard troops then fall under the control of the President of the United States? But it's under a completely different part of the law than the President would use to federalize the National Guard.
Of course, in some African countries and elsewhere, there is no legal firewall between the military and domestic law enforcement, at least in the way we separate them.
Part of the reason for that is the military is usually the best organized institution. And it's a small step from saying we're the most organized, best led institution to saying we should be in charge. That is a slippery slope to dictatorship. And it would be much better in most cases for civil society to develop and the military to be separated from the governing bodies of whatever state we're talking about.
And you're saying that this is a settled issue here in the U.S.
So the United States is 245 years old, and we're still working on this. But by and large, the ethos of our professional military is that they answer to civilian authority and they need to stay out of domestic politics. Even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley, apologized for appearing with the president in that photo op in Lafayette Square.
Retired U.S. Army Colonel Peter Mansour is a professor of military history at Ohio State University, and he was speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In mid-July 1995, Bosnian Serbs invaded a United Nations safe area in Bosnia and Herzegovina and committed the single worst crime in Europe since World War II, the murder of more than 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys. This month, we commemorate the 25th anniversary of the Srebrenica genocide. After the breakup of Yugoslavia in the early 1990s, ethno-nationalism drove up tensions and animosities among the myriad ethnic groups that made up the country, culminating in the Yugoslav Wars, first in Croatia and Slovenia, and then in multi-ethnic Bosnia and Herzegovina. At the start of the war, the population of eastern Bosnia-Herzegovina was mostly Bosniak, a majority Muslim Bosnian ethnic group. For over 3 years, the Bosniak population there was terrorized by Bosnian Serb nationalists. Thousands of lives were lost and homes and livelihoods destroyed. On July 1995, units of the Bosnian Serb Army of Republika Srpska, under the command of General Ratko Mladic, forcibly entered the besieged enclave of Srebrenica, which had been declared a safe area 2 years earlier under the United Nations protection. The town was teeming with tens of thousands of refugees from the surrounding villages who had sought shelter there. The Serbian troops rounded up the population, separated the women and youngest children, and then systematically murdered all males over the age of 15. Between July 11th and 25th, they massacred 8,372 unarmed men and boys simply because they were Bosniak. The 1948 United Nations Genocide Convention defines genocide as acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. And that is what happened in Srebrenica, according to a report issued in 2004 by the Commission for Investigation of the Events in and Around Srebrenica. The two men most responsible for the Srebrenica massacre were former Bosnian Serb president Radovan Karadzic and his military commander Ratko Mladic. Both were eventually captured and tried before the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and found guilty of committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. 25 years after the atrocities in Srebrenica, we extend our deepest condolences to the families of the victims of the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina. It is a time to reflect on the terrible tragedy of Srebrenica and recommit to holding accountable those responsible for crimes against humanity anywhere. The 25-year anniversary of the Srebrenica genocide also reminds us of the importance of peace in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and it provides a renewed opportunity for its leaders to take the necessary steps toward building lasting trust, mutual respect, and reconciliation. This is essential to ensure that a tragedy like Srebrenica is never repeated and that Bosnia and Herzegovina moves towards a more stable and prosperous future for all of its citizens.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.